Mars has got an atmosphere. It's 95% CO2. We know that for a fact. We know that for a fact from the Viking landers and the Pathfinder lander. Now, carbon dioxide can be reacted with hydrogen in the presence of a catalyst to produce methane, that's CH4, and water, H2O. This is known as the Sabatier reaction. It's been practiced in the chemical industry since the 1890s. It's a very easy reaction to make occur. It's exothermic. It needs no energy. It produces energy, actually. So methane, natural gas, that's wonderful rocket fuel. We'll store that in our tank. That's the fuel to come home. And the water we take and we electrolyze, we split it into hydrogen and oxygen. The oxygen we store in our other tanks, that's the oxidizer to burn the methane with. And the hydrogen we recycle to react with more carbon dioxide to make more methane and more water and so forth. And then to make additional oxygen, which we can use, we run a third reactor in which we just take in carbon dioxide and split it into carbon monoxide and oxygen. The oxygen we store in our tank, that's useful oxidizer. The carbon monoxide we vent as waste. So when you're all done, what you've managed to do is take 6 tons of hydrogen from Earth and turn it into 108 tons of methane oxygen bipropellant on the surface of Mars. That is a leverage of 18 to 1. Now, the point, though, is you got lots of leverage here. And because we can make so much propellant, we make extra propellant, which will allow us to use on Mars ground vehicles that run on combustion engines. And you really want to be able to do that, you see, because a combustion engine-powered car has a much higher power-to-mass ratio than you can get with a battery-powered car. Because what we're saying here is that the ability to make fuel on Mars makes the mission cheap, but it does something else. It makes it effective. Okay? And that's critical, because there is no point going to Mars unless you can do something useful when you get there. And the number one requirement to do something useful on Mars in the way of exploration is surface mobility. And that's what you get if you can make your fuels on Mars. It took 8 months to fly to Mars. It took 10 months to make the propellant. That's 18 months. There's 26 months in between launch windows from Earth to Mars. So, long before the next launch window has opened up, we will know that we have a fully fueled Earth return vehicle sitting, waiting for us on the Martian surface. That being the case, the next launch window, 2007, October 2007, mark your calendar, okay, we launch 2 more boosters to Mars. One shoots out another one of these Earth return vehicle fuel factory objects. The other shoots out a habitat with a crew of 4 astronauts in it. Now, because our return ride is waiting for us on the surface of Mars, we don't need to fly to Mars in some gigantic Death Star spaceship. We don't even need to fly to Mars in a comparatively modest Millennium Falcon. No, we can fly to Mars in a tuna can. And that is a very good thing, ladies and gentlemen, because we know how to build tuna cans, and they've been proven in commerce to be an extremely efficient shape for volumetric packaging purposes. Now, of course, our tuna can is somewhat larger than your standard chicken of the sea unit. It is about 8.5 meters in diameter, and it's got about 6 meters of can here, giving you 2 decks, each with 2.5 meters of useful headroom. The upper deck is real habitat space. That's where the people really live. The lower deck is more of a garage, cargo hold, workshop kind of place. This is the upper deck of the HAB. And what you can see here is a little stateroom for each of the 4 astronauts. Then there's another number of public areas for science, a galley, a wardroom, an exercise room. And in the center, we have a solar flare storm shelter. Okay, now this is worth talking about for a minute. There's 2 kinds of radiation that can get you in interplanetary space. There's cosmic rays and solar flares. They're very different from each other. Solar flares come from the sun. Okay, pretty obvious. Okay, and they are events that occur in an unpredictable way. You might get a nice big one about once a year. Okay, they could hit any time, although more probable during solar max than solar min and so forth. Okay, but anyway, they can come out of the blue and they can blast you, and in the course of several hours, they can deliver a dose of several thousand rems of radiation to an unshielded astronaut, which is enough to kill. That is bad. Okay? The good news, however, is that the kind of radiation that solar flares are made out of are basically protons with energies on the order of 1,000,000 volts. And that stuff can be stopped by 12 centimeters of water, or things that from the nuclear point of view are basically the same thing as water, such as food, or things that water and food become as the mission develops. We have enough of that stuff on board the ship to pack it in around the central corridor here and be able to shield a limited area of the ship completely against solar flare radiation. So what happens is, if the solar flare happens, the alarm bell rings, and everybody goes in here, and they're crammed in there pretty tight for a few hours until the all clear rings, and then you come out of the shelter and it's over. And it's going to happen once, it might happen twice, conceivably it could happen 3 times in the course of the mission. And that's how you're safe against solar flares. Solar flares were a real terror for Apollo, the moon missions. Because, you see, the moon missions were only a couple of weeks in duration. So we didn't have much supplies on board. So there was no way to shield Apollo crews against solar flares. We were counting upon luck to be able to dash out to the moon and back in a short enough time that the chance of being hit by a solar flare was low. And as it happens, we managed to pull that off. But on a Mars mission, you're going to be in space much longer, and you probably will be hit by a solar flare. But precisely because it is a long mission, 2.5 years in total, perforce you have enough supplies on board the ship to make a flare shelter out of them. So the mission can armor itself against the flare. Now the other kind of space radiation is totally different. It's cosmic rays. Now cosmic rays do not come from the sun. In fact, no one really understands where they do come from, although there are theories. But in any case, they come from outside our solar system. And they're particles that come zipping into our solar system with energies, not of 1,000,000 volts per particle, but 1,000,000,000 volts per particle. 1,000 times more energy, particle for particle, than a solar flare particle. So you can't stop those with 12 centimeters of water. They'll just whip right through that. No, you need more like 5 meters of water to stop most of the cosmic rays. And we don't have enough mass of stuff on board the ship to do that. So you're going to take that dose. You're going to take the dose. That's the bad news. The good news, however, is that the magnitude of the dose just isn't that big. It's around 50 rem for every year you're in interplanetary space in the Earth-Mars regions of the solar system. And we're going to be in space for a year on this mission. We're going to be 6 months out. We're going to be 6 months back. We're 1.5 years on the surface of Mars. But on Mars, you can be shielded. You can put sandbags on the roof of the HAB. There's things you can do. The place you actually get the dose is in transit. So we're going to get our 50 rems scattered over 2.5 year period. Well, what is that? Well, 50 rems scattered over a long period like that represents no prompt risk to the crew. One would not expect to see any immediate effects. Rather, what it represents is a statistical risk. Basically, a statistical risk of about 1% of getting a fatal cancer at some point later in your life, assuming no advance in medical technique. Well, 1% chance of dying of cancer, that doesn't sound that great. But you need to put it in perspective. Right now, if you're an average American or Australian, okay, and you do not smoke, you have a 20% chance that you will die of cancer. This would make it 21. If you are an average smoker, it's 40. So if we recruited the crew out of smokers and sent them to Mars without their tobacco, we would be reducing their chance of getting cancer. So one reason, therefore, to send people to Mars would be for their health. Now, another thing you'll notice about this habitat is that, in one sense at least, it's a very conventional environment. That is, we don't ordinarily live in round houses. But look, here's a table and chairs and shelves and a sink. This thing is designed to be used in a gravity environment. It can operate in zero gravity, and it does for a few hours in a couple of different intermediate phases of the mission. But mostly it operates in gravity. we're going to land this thing on Mars. We're going to use it as our house on Mars, where there is gravity, albeit at 38% terrestrial levels. And on the way out to Mars, we're going to make gravity by tethering off the burnt-out upper stage of the booster that threw us to Mars. This is the Ares upper stage. This is the habitat on its aeroshell. We extend a tether a kilometer and a half long, and we spin this thing up at one revolution per minute. We create Mars normal gravity in the habitat. And the purpose of doing that is to avoid the extremely deleterious effects of long-duration exposure to zero gravity that we saw on the cosmonaut crews of the Mir and its predecessor Soviet Salyut space stations in the 1990s and 80s. You know, these cosmonauts would go up there for 6 months or a year, or in one case a year and a half, and after they landed, they'd have to be hauled off on stretchers. And according to the Russians, nothing, no countermeasures worked. They tried exercises that didn't work. They still landed in terrible shape and took weeks to recover. Now, Shannon actually did the exercises, and in consequence, she landed in acceptable condition to function immediately in a 1G gravity environment on Earth, let alone a 1/3 G environment on Mars. So what she proved, I mean, is well, you know, it's like in the old, about 100 years ago, when there were still wooden sailing ships around, but they were kind of on their way out, and the iron steam ships were coming in strong. And, you know, the old salts were hanging around the docks and, you know, saying, you know, to the young whippersnappers on their steamships, you know, look, the seven seas were not won by iron ships and wooden men. They were won by iron men and wooden ships. Okay, well, you know, Shannon Lucid proved the Iron Woman theory of spaceflight and showed that if you have people as self-disciplined as she is, you can actually go to Mars on a six-month flight in zero gravity and land in perfectly acceptable condition. But if we still want to be able to send men to Mars, the artificial gravity is to be advised. And the it's a better idea, okay? Because, look, you know, you don't want to put this kind of burden on the crew. And if you do have a crew that's disciplined enough to exercise like this, they'll land in better shape if they also have artificial gravity on the spaceship. So that is why I think that that's the right way to go, despite the fact that Shannon showed that you could, in principle, do it the other way. In any case, look, they take 6 months to fly to Mars. When they get close to Mars, they fire what is called a pyrobolt. That cuts this cord. This thing goes bye-bye into interplanetary space. They then aerobrake into Mars orbit, and after we check them out and check out the weather, we go and land them at site number one, where the fully fueled Earth return vehicle is waiting for them. Now, we have been on the ground at site number one, robotically speaking, for 2 years. We have thoroughly explored the local area with little robotic rovers, okay, that have taken pictures of everything that's going to be used to train the crew doing the landing. We got a radar beacon on the ground to draw them in. We got an ace fly in this thing. We should be able to land, pow, right on the spot. And some of you, in fact, may recall, and others may have read, that during the Apollo program in 1970, we landed an Apollo lunar lander within 200 meters of a Surveyor spacecraft that had been placed on the moon a couple of years prior. And we have much better guidance systems today. So we should be able to hit it on the nose. But let's say we don't. Let's say we land 10, 20, 30, 50 kilometers off course. These would be spectacular landing errors. We're still okay. Because we have with us in the lower deck of the habitat a pressurized ground roving vehicle about the size of a 4x4. It runs on a methane oxygen combustion engine, and it has a one-way driving range of 1,000 kilometers. So it would really take piss poor piloting to land outside of the radius of action of that vehicle. But let's say that's what happens. Let's say they land, okay, you know, here, okay, on the wrong side of the planet, which, by the way, would represent a very serious problem with the pilot selection process. If that were to occur, We can still save the mission because we got the second Earth return vehicle following them out to Mars. And if they did land on the wrong side of the planet, we can save the mission by bringing this down to land near them wherever they did land. And that one would be done accurately because it would be automated. Now, in that case, we would be depending upon the chemical synthesis gear in the second Earth return vehicle to work in real time as opposed to past time, which is the baseline of the mission. But the success of the technology has already been proven by the first lander. Okay? And in any case, we have a human crew on the scene to adjust the gear should it malfunction once they're there. Although you probably wouldn't want to have the pilot involved in that. Okay. But in any case, it's a third-level mission backup, and as such, it's pretty good. And finally, as a fourth-level backup on the mission, if all of that fails, if we cannot land accurately, if we cannot drive there, if we cannot use the second Earth return vehicle, the fourth-level backup on the mission is that we have the whole crew landed on Mars, where there is natural gravity, where they have substantial radiation protection offered by the Martian environment, and they got enough supplies with them to last for 3 years. So that if worse comes to worst, they could just tough it out on the surface of Mars until more supplies and another Earth return vehicle can be fired out to them at that time. So what we have here is a four-layer defense in depth on the mission. And each layer involves successfully carrying off the mission. But let's say the mission plan works the way it's supposed to. We land over here at site number one. You know, we already had an automated health checkout on this thing before we ever left Earth, but now we can get out and inspect it manually. We can kick the tires. The thing's in great shape. What do we do with the second Earth return vehicle? We land it somewhere else, site number two, several hundred kilometers away, where it starts making propellant, which it will use to support the second piloted mission, which will fly out to it in 2009, along with another Earth return vehicle, which is their backup, but which otherwise is used to open up site number three. So the idea here is that every 2 years we launch two boosters to Mars, one to open up the new site, one to exploit the previously open site. Two boosters every 2 years is an average of one per year to support a continuous program of human exploration of Mars. Now, the United States currently launches six shuttles a year. So one per year is one-sixth of that, 16%. We're talking about using 16% of our available heavy lift launch capability in order to support this program. That is something that we can easily afford to do. Thank you.